Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin, joined by Mike Malott, Jacob Kanzen, our special guest this week, John Trescott of Trescott Rossman. Thanks for joining us today.
Glad to be here.
Later in the podcast, Representative Brant Eyden will be joining us. He's the new chair of the Ways and Means Committee. We'll talk about what that committee has in store, what kind of vision he has for that coming up here in a little bit. But a lot of news this week, guys. Let's start with the State of the State address. John, we want to start with you. What was your takeaway from that?
I thought it was a good speech. It was exactly what I expected. The governor has talked about these issues over and over again, so we knew that they were priority issues. I thought it was well delivered. I kind of looked to, especially at the end of the speech, when she reached out to the leadership of the House and the Senate, and it was a warm, friendly, it was a nice moment at the end that I think says, hey, we want to work together. We're not always going to agree, but I thought overall the speech was constructed well, had a lot of good issues in it that will be detailed as the budget comes out and the spring goes on.
I think that the leaders, Jacob, were a little caught off guard by the references to their families there at the end. Each one of the quadrant getting a little special recognition there and a little personal shout out, I guess, if you will, that I'm not quite sure they were expecting.
Yeah, I mean, that's the impression we got from following up on that with Senator Shirky. But I think the governor there maybe was trying to show her experience. I mean, she knows these people. She wants to build bridges, as she's said many times. And I think she was trying to come across in that way in her speech.
Yeah, it's almost like she's already trying to connect with these people personally. You got to basically do this in one of these, like, what do they call these dates where you go and you get like 5 seconds
like
with them?
Speed dating
kind of
thing.
Dating kind of thing. It's like she's building relationships on a speed date here or something like that.
And well, really, this is the way the relationships among legislators and leaders used to be. They knew each other's families. They knew when their kids' birthdays were. So it really does, I think, harken back to 20, 30 years ago and in how legislators could come fight it out during the day, but they were still friendly with each other after work.
Mike, you had the vantage point of sitting on the House chamber floor, outside of it being extremely cramped. what was kind of the mood in the chamber?
Very receptive. It was obvious, though, as the speech went on, that the Democrats were giving more standing ovations to her speech than Republicans were. There was a period of time where there was a long string of Democrat-only ovations, and when she mentioned that she wanted to fix auto insurance, she got the Republicans up on their feet, too, and she made a joke about that. But overall, I think both sides were pretty receptive to the message.
So I think I've been covering, I think this was my 17th State of the State address that I've covered, John. I think the reaction to every single one of them is, we got to have more details. There are no details.
Yes, you're absolutely right. That is the criticism every time. And I think it really goes back to the State of the State's intent is to lay out the governor's agenda for the year. What's the cadence? What's going to be rolled out? Let's set the agenda and the tone for the year. The details always come in the budget. That's where it's all laid out. Now, one of the things that we had done when I was with Governor Engler is we always had legislation ready to go the following week or things that really fleshed out a lot of the policy initiatives in the speech. And we're probably not going to see that, especially this being her first year in office. But, you know, I think it's really par for the course in terms of the criticism of lack of specifics. This speech is not really for specifics.
She gave more details on the direction that she wanted to head with the education portion of it than the roads. And roads was a signature issue. So I was expecting to hear a little bit more about what direction she was heading for the roads. The education portion seemed actually fairly well developed.
Yeah, I think more so. And I will say, can you imagine if she would have said, okay, here are all the details of my plan to pay for roads? That would have been the only story that everybody would have written about. It would have been all the headlines, and nobody would have covered anything else. So, you know, that's why you have lack of specifics in certain areas so that you get the broader agenda covered. And I think she did spark quite a conversation on education and quite an appropriate focus.
I've been doing these On These Days in Michigan History for the newsletter, and I go back into time to see how prior governors, and I'm talking like way back to like Fred Green in the 20s or the 30s or so forth, how they did their State of the State addresses. In some cases, they actually wrote them out, and sometimes they were in the middle of the day. And when they actually did details, and some of these old governors actually did details, there's stories about how these speeches went like 2-3 hours. I mean, could you imagine sitting in that House chamber for 2 or 3 hours, Jacob, just sitting there listening to all these details? The stories afterwards were like complete sensory overload. I mean, there was so much information. It's like, please help me. I don't want all these details.
I'd be like sitting in a 3-hour-long lecture. Those were always the worst classes back at State.
I'm sure no drinking was involved during those days either, just to get through it.
Well, we're actually going to the Prohibition era, but again, the drinking, but just maybe a little bit more illegal back then than it is, would be now, I suppose. And so then after the State of the State, we had a story from Fox 2 News that has gotten a little bit of publicity now about the social media reaction to the governor's dress. And Jacob, from a journalism standpoint, there's a danger in writing something about what folks are parroting about on social media. Sometimes that stuff just isn't news, is it?
I think there's two issues here. One is, yeah, just reporting on social media commentary. I mean, I guess maybe it's akin to just parroting back what people are saying in a newspaper comment section. I mean,
edit those, right? I mean, even in the editorial pages, I mean, we don't write crude comments about the governor, about, sexual innuendos. I mean, that letter doesn't get published.
Yeah. And so, I mean, I guess the question is always, as journalists need to consider, is what is the news value? What are we trying to get across? And from our understanding, or at least from the official statement from Fox 2, is that they wanted to, I guess, you know, show that this was a perspective, or people were actually saying these things about the governor. And so I guess that is kind of what's up for debate right now.
It seemed like maybe this was hit count driven. That could be something to do with it. That maybe we're just trying to boost hit counts. What do you think of that, Mike?
Well, that's an angle I hadn't thought of, quite frankly.
Because that's what's driving the news these days, right? How many times are you getting a click on your website?
Absolutely. I came from another organization where they wanted us to be reading those metrics on how many people were reading and how deep in the story they were reading, and exactly what line they ended on, so that you knew how to rewrite your stories to bring the information up. And it was all about metrics. Frankly, drove me nuts. But it's very dangerous when you start going by the clicks. Just look at the clickbait that you see on the internet. Some of that stuff gets crude really fast.
And so let's talk about how the governor handled it. John, what was your impression on how she did with it?
I was very impressed. I thought her tweets and response, and she had a string of them, I thought they were brilliant. She started with, I'm paraphrasing, but boys have been making fun of my curves since I was, I don't know how old, but young. So she made light of it. I think she made the people making these comments, made them look small without really engaging in a back and forth with them. And she stayed above it, and also issued a defense for other young girls who would be out there who may be made fun of because of their shape or something. And she said, I've got your back. That's a brilliant message to send when people are really, I think, just putting out stupidity in terms of their commentary. This is an irrelevant follow-up. It does expose the double standard. You really wouldn't see men being made fun of because something was too tight or their pants were too short or, you know, whatever. It just doesn't happen much. So I really admire her response and the way she stayed above the fray.
You know, I guess if this were red carpet time and we were going to the Grammys and Gretchen Whitmer was walking down the red carpet and we were Access Hollywood and we had the fashion people on and everyone has their comments on this or that and how this and that works and looks and whatever, I guess that would be one thing. But I guess if you're putting yourself out as a real news outlet, you might want to just leave this one alone.
On the red carpet, those people are paid to look good or to appear a certain way.
That's a good
point. They put out their image. So they're putting themselves out there because of their appearance or because of their clothes, and they're wearing certain designers, and designers are giving them free stuff. It's a completely different environment than somebody in politics. So I just think that type of commentary should be off limits in politics.
All right. So what it did, though, is that stories or coverage about that bounced maybe the most significant news item of the entire week off of the front and down the web pages on the Detroit News and Free Press. And the most significant story was that an executive order was rejected by the state legislature for the first time since the 70s. And that was fairly significant. And John, I wanted you here in part because you were with Governor Engler back in the 90s when he also faced some criticisms having to do with the restructuring of the Department of Natural Resources. And it was kind of the same thing.
You know, I view this week and kind of what went on, and I'm not making any comparison to be taken wrong, but it's like if you're out in the wilderness and there's two old bulls kind of facing off, and they want to show which one's stronger or which one's the alpha, and they will face off and they'll issue that challenge. This really is, with all the new people, they're staking out their claim.
Yeah,
exactly. I don't think that this is something that will be a legacy issue, but they are saying, hey, I'm the new governor, I'm in charge, I can do this, it's within my right. And the legislature is going, well, we have some authority here too to reject it. So they're both letting the other one know that they're relevant. I will go back to very early 90s when Governor Engler split up the DNR and created the DEQ. We handled it very poorly.
You think so?
Yeah, we issued an executive order and hadn't briefed really hardly anybody. We hadn't worked with any of the advocacy groups that were out there. And this was, you know, you get an entrenched bureaucracy and special interest groups that work with that bureaucracy, and they are used to doing things in a certain way, and you upset their life and throw in some change, and now they were all over us. It was just, we didn't do the background work or the education of what we were doing as we should have. We just plowed forward. And we always use that as, we're never going to do it that way again. We're going to get out there and explain it. So, you know, mistakes are made by new governors as they're trying to exercise their authority. They learn from it, they correct it, and they do much better in the future.
Did you guys end up retracting that and then putting out a new one? I'm trying to remember looking at some of the old research. It seems that there was one where the governor had it out there and he was like, let me rejigger it a little bit and try again.
We did that with one of them. I can't remember if it was okay. DNR or not, because this was pretty early. This was like 91 or 92. And, you know, what he was trying to do is separate conservation from environmental protection. It has held up until just, you know, a few weeks ago. So it worked pretty well, but the implementation of it was very clunky.
Mike, I want to get your perceptions on what you saw in covering the executive order rejection, because you were in at least two committees on this and got to cover some floor action on it as well.
You could have scripted the whole thing from the beginning, including the quotes. Everybody's position was exactly what you would have expected at the outset.
There was no crossover because this was a turf war. This was, in a way, a partisan turf war.
Yeah, and I think the governor should have... I suspect she did know exactly what was going to happen from the beginning.
I wouldn't say partisan, maybe more structural, more governmental turf war here, because it just does happen to be that one's Democrat and one's Republican. But this is about executive branch versus legislative branch, maybe more than anything. And that's just how things turned out. Last thing we want to touch on you with here, John, since you're here. You sit on the Michigan Capital Commission.
Yes.
And there is going to be some continued renovations going on here at the back end of the Capitol. Give us a little bit of a briefing on what's going to happen here with this new Heritage Hall and how long we're going to see the back end of the Capitol dug up.
Well, first of all, the name Heritage Hall will change at some point. That's kind of a holding name for the project. But yeah, we were at the end of last year given the authorization and most of the funding to add on a section. One thing that we've been concerned about for a long time is when kids come in, the safety and security and having a gathering place for them, and then also protecting the building, because we have, you know, a couple hundred thousand visitors a year. It is a living, breathing museum. And we really have no place for kids to gather and really learn about the building before they go in. There are small rooms where they're given a quick video. We want to make that experience a lot better. So we're adding, I think the space will be about 50,000 square feet. It will be in the northwest corner of the property. So buses, when this is done, will enter from the north side of the building. They'll be able to pull up and not have to walk in front of the bus. They'll get out directly and walk in. So we've got that safety portion that's very, very important. Once they're in, there will be larger gathering areas to help educate them. We want to make this like a true museum, so the technology that will go into this space will be really important as far as helping kids understand the history of the building and what goes on there. And it's going to be a very attractive entrance. It will have all the security measures that some of the best buildings in the country will have. And then what I really am impressed with is the skylights that are designed into it. So even though you're walking in under what now is underground, you'll be able to look up at the building, at the dome, and that will be a focal point visually. There's also going to be a very large auditorium. So programming that we haven't been able to pull off to date because we didn't have the space, the auditorium right now is intended to be seat about 600 people. So you think about the expansion and the opportunities that we have to do different type of programs.
Wow, you could almost have the state of the state there if you wanted to.
It would be a great place for the state of the state. You could invite a much broader audience, and the Senate wouldn't be cramped up in the corner, basically sitting on each other's laps.
Because you know they're excited about that, right? Sitting over where the press usually sits. And you know what I'm most excited about is that the entrance right there on Ottawa is quicker access for us as we're walking down from MERS down Ottawa.
Absolutely.
we can sneak right in that entrance and into the Capitol.
You want to make a motion? We'll call that the MERS entrance.
Yeah, there you go. I like that. Quicker entrance. As long as there's a bike rack there, we'll be all set there.
I can park. Bike racks around.
Park my bike right there. We'll be good to go. All right. Well, let's get in Brant Iden here. Joining me now for the podcast is Brant Iden. He is the representative out of Oshtemo Township. Did I pronounce that right?
Oshtemo. Close. Kalamazoo.
The Kalamazoo area. Thanks for joining us on the podcast.
Yeah, great to be here. Thanks for having me.
We're in your new Capitol office here, and of course, you're wearing the bow tie. How many bow ties do you have? Take a guess.
I have a large collection, probably well over 100 now.
100?
Probably. I like bow tie Thursdays, but now, you know, I have so many, I mix that into bow ties Tuesday as well. So I've got 2 days a week now, typically, with a bow tie.
So is that how it works then? So you do the regular ties on Wednesdays, and then you do the bow ties on Tuesday and Thursday?
I do. I mix it up. Yeah, I mix it up.
That's pretty exciting. That takes a little bit of pre-planning here.
It does take some planning. Yes, it does.
All right. So a couple things I wanted to touch on. First, last session, you were the point person on making reforms to online gaming and also fantasy sports. And things didn't work out. The governor didn't sign those bills. Were you surprised by that?
I was, and I think a lot of my colleagues were as well. We had invested 2 years of time in that package, and of course it also included updates to the Gaming Control Act, which hadn't been updated in 20 years. And really, this was a great bipartisan group of folks. We had great support from the Detroit delegation. As you know, veto-proof majorities on all of the bills, including the 3/4 obviously required to change the Constitution for the Gaming Act control update. And it was very surprising to me.
He had to have given some kind of indication, like if you attach it to the reforms to the charitable gaming, which we know that he didn't like. He didn't want to dilute the authority of the Gaming Control Board as it relates to overseeing charitable gaming. But he had to give some kind of clue, didn't he? You attach it to that bill and the whole thing goes down.
You would have thought, and you know, intentionally we didn't tie bar it to that charitable gaming bill because we knew that there was opposition to that bill. Of course, the Senator Jones bill, and then in the House, Tom Barrett at the time. But we moved forward anyway, did not tie bar the charitable gaming bill, and thought that that would actually make this something that would be more palatable to the governor. Again, no indication along the line from anyone that he would not be interested in potentially signing this. And I speculate perhaps it was because he didn't think we could get it done. You know, there's always that. And of course, you know, the governor really never weighed in on any particular, the former governor never weighed in on any particular legislation before it was signed anyway. That was just sort of his way of operating. But I will say this, we had a great package of bills. And, you know, the veto letter I was very disappointed with. I do not believe that there were any concerns at lottery. The governor articulated in his veto letter. In fact, upon follow-up, I'm hearing that there's not. And so again, I just just speculate that this was just something he didn't like for one reason or another.
So have you had any conversations with the new governor? Is this something that you want to pursue going into the next session?
Well, this is definitely my top agenda item as I go into the next session. We're not going to run right out of the gates with it. You have to remember it took us 2 years to get it to the point where we were able to get it across the finish line during lame duck. And there's a lot of education as it comes to gaming-related issues. There's a lot of stakeholders involved. Obviously, we've got 23 tribal casinos in the state, 3 commercial casinos, a robust lottery, and there's a lot of players involved. And we've got a lot of new members on both sides of the aisle, in the House and in the Senate, and I just want to make sure that they are very comfortable with the bills before we move forward with them. As it relates to the governor, I will say that I have not directly spoken with her, but in talking to her policy staff about it, they're asking a lot of great questions. We're having some very good conversation. No commitments yet, but I will say that it's been very positive, and I'm going to move forward with it.
I understand that there were some changes made at the federal level in regards to online gaming, and the online gaming that the lottery currently offers could be in jeopardy, and so could any future online gaming expansion in the state. Have you taken a look at that, and how concerned are you that whatever you do here may be for naught?
Well, very good question. First and foremost, I don't think that there have been any changes at the federal level. Obviously, the DOJ opinion that came out about 3 weeks ago now, just that. It's an opinion piece from the DOJ. And okay. It just says that, look, online lottery and other online forms of gaming may be a problem for us, is basically what the whole thing says. But again, it's just an opinion piece. And if you follow the opinion piece, it makes no sense, because really it would negate every online lottery that's out there, and I would argue it would potentially even negate any lottery that's done across state lines. That'd be like a Powerball, things like that.
Mega Millions?
Mega Millions would be another one that could potentially be in jeopardy, and I think that if the federal government moves forward with any action on the DOJ opinion, you will see states stepping up and probably entering into litigation against the federal government on the issue. So, more likely, it's just the fact that this opinion sits out there. The federal government perhaps does nothing. Similar to how they act with the marijuana. They don't like it, but it's a state's rights issue, and if the states continue to pursue it, they're not going to intervene.
So you're just going to move forward regardless at this point. That's your...
Yeah, my plan is to continue to march forward and make sure that we've got the best policy in the country and make sure it's model legislation for other states, which it has been thus far. And you're seeing right now there's 23 bills across the country that have been introduced in state legislatures as it relates to online gaming or sports gaming of some kind. And Michigan was at the forefront of that, and I think we've still got great policy. I'm going to reintroduce this and move forward.
So how'd you get into this subject of gaming and fantasy sports? Do you have a fantasy football team?
I don't currently, but participated in a lot of fantasy. I don't have the time anymore, unfortunately, did used to participate a lot. But
How good were you? Were you any good?
I was okay, but I do love sports gaming. Legally, of course. When I'm in Nevada and now New Jersey, I place a wager or two, and I had some football bets out there. I did well on Tom Brady this year.
Did you really?
I did. I had some money out there on Brady, and the Pats came through for me.
And you must be a U of M fan. That must be why you went on Brady.
So here's my deal. And so I went to Kalamazoo College, as everybody knows. Not a strong football team at Kalamazoo, although they were very good this year. I played tennis there. But I will say this. I like Michigan State. I like Michigan. And I root for both teams. And when they play each other, I root for the team that's playing at home.
There you go. You can't cut it down the middle any better than that.
That's right.
I was going to ask you, if you had a fantasy football team, what you called it? Did you have a funny name or something?
No, I mixed it up each cycle, and I actually haven't participated in about 3 years now. I just get too busy.
Yeah, no, I understand. Well, now you're going to get a lot busier, because you're going to be the chair of a new committee, a new structure that Lee Chatfield, the Speaker of the House, has set up. Ways and Means Committee Chair, which is going to be overseeing several other policy committees. When he approached you with this idea, what did you think?
Well, I thought it was a great idea. This is something that the Speaker and I had been talking about for at least a year, if not more. And really, the conversation continue to come back to, how can we make policy better in the House? Obviously, there's a two-step process for appropriations, and we thought, why shouldn't there be something similar as it relates to the policy side of the House? I mean, bills need to, at times, be vetted better, and we believe that this structure will do that. We tinkered around with some different ideas and decided that the setup that we have now, of course, where you have government ops, judiciary, appropriations, and ways and means that can all pass bills to the floor, will make first and foremost his job easier, because at the end of the day I do serve at the pleasure of the speaker, and that's my job, and it's to take some arrows for the caucus. It's to make sure that we're at the same time negotiating the best policy that we can and ensuring that everybody, all the stakeholders that are involved in the legislation, have got a voice. And sometimes bills take a little bit further vetting, and sometimes they don't, and so you're going to see that, you're going to see my committee operate that way.
Was there any bills that kind of spurred this along where there was something on the floor you guys saw that it came up and you're like, boy, that's a stink pot. How did that ever get out of committee? Or, you know, there was bills that were just completely rewritten on the floor and you're like, why'd you even go through this process?
Well, I'm not going to pinpoint any particular bills, but there are bills that fit the description of both those that you just articulated. I mean, you see every cycle. Sometimes it's by design, I think. Sometimes it's just an error, but folks come late to the party for whatever reason it happens to be. Sometimes things get missed. Sometimes people recognize that there's something that perhaps is moving that they didn't think was going to move, and now we're subbing things out on the floor. We're making amendments on the floor, and frankly, members get frustrated with that. There's a lot of activity as we get later into the year, and this is an opportunity for the members to get more familiar with the bills that are coming through from both chambers, and at the same time ensure that we are thoroughly vetting policy. One of the things that I continually heard, you know, this is my fifth year coming into my final term, and from my day one is serving in the House, I always heard that, well, the Senate was the more deliberative body. Mm-hmm. Everybody says, so the Senate's the more deliberative body. I turned to the speaker one day and I said, Speaker Chatfield, and I said, why does the Senate have to be the more deliberative body? Why can't the House do good policy work as well? And so I believe we've come up with a good system. Obviously, have not had our first meeting yet because we don't have any bills in front of us. We're going to wait to get through the State of the State address next week. And I believe that policy committees are now starting to hear some legislation perhaps this week and into next week. And so you should probably see us meet within the next 2 weeks, and we're going to start our deliberative process to make sure we're making great policy here in the House.
So what I'm hearing is that one of the goals is to try and limit this situation where we have bills that are subbed on the floor, numerous amendments, nobody really knows what's going on. All we know is that the board is up and it's time to vote.
Yeah, that's exactly correct. And of course, you can't, because of the way things work, you can't always totally eliminate that, I should say. But we are going to mitigate that to the best of our ability and make sure that members are comfortable with what they've got in front of them, make sure that the bills, if they do need a sub, if they do need amendments, that's done within the Ways and Means Committee. Perhaps bills need to be sent back to the original committee for further work. And we have the ability to do that as well. And then we do, of course, just have the ability to pass them directly to the floor. You know, I don't envision that any highway naming bills are going to need any additional work. So,
now, do you envision any bills just being sent right to Ways and Means, or is that not really how it's going to go?
So that's not the intention of the committee. The committee does have the ability to take bills directly as original jurisdiction, and the speaker set that up intentionally, I'm certain. But again, that's going to be his call. If there are bills that need to come directly there for perhaps timing purposes or whatever reason he deems necessary, perhaps they will start there. But that's not our intent. We're going to start the bills in their original committees, their original policy committees, and work them through the process. That's the whole point of having this dual review process.
What have you heard from some of the members in regards to this? I'm sure there's some chairs who are grumbling a little bit, like, why, we're not good enough?
Have they come up to you and given you a rough time about this?
No, actually, they haven't. Now, maybe they've been beating up the speaker about it, but they have not. I will say this. Actually, I have not heard anything negative as it relates to that. In fact, many of the members and many of our my senior class members that have been committee chairs before have come to me, and they've all really articulated, look, we think that this is going to be a strong process. The floor leader and I have discussed this, floor leader Cole and I have discussed this in depth, and we believe believe that this is going to make for better policy at the end of the day. And the chairs, I think, agree with that. They're still going to do their committee work. There's going to be a lot of work done in committee, and we're just there to make sure that that in case there's any last-minute changes, we catch it before it goes to the floor.
Representative Brant Idem from Oshtemo Township. I think I got it right the second time here. Thanks for joining us on the podcast. Appreciate it.
Great to be with you. Thanks, King Kyle.
That's going to do it for this week's edition of MERS Monday. Thanks to Representative Idem for taking some time. All right, President's Day. It's President's Day weekend, and let's end with our favorite president. John, who is your favorite president? And while you guys are thinking about this, here's a little bit of Kyle trivia for anyone who really cares, and I'm sure nobody does. When I was a kid, I used to collect old William McKinley paraphernalia to keep myself occupied when my mom was going through antique shows. So I have a box. I haven't even put this out in my house yet, and we've had our house for a while, but I've got like books and coins and all this kind of stuff from like 1900 of William McKinley, just randomly because I like the Irish name, I guess.
I hope you've read Karl Rove's book about McKinley and his election and everything. It's fascinating.
Oh, about Hannah and how the guy kind of bought it, or how he campaigned from his front porch, yes, because his wife was sick.
Yeah. It's a fascinating book that gets into how the county conventions operate and everything. It's really well researched. I would say favorite president has to be Ronald Reagan. I grew
you
up
are
with
a
him.
Republican.
I
Jeez,
am,
geez.
But I was also in college during the Reagan years, and being in college, professors didn't necessarily care for Ronald Reagan. So you know the indoctrination from the other side on that. But I've also been to his museum, and when you look keep everything in perspective that he did and the change that occurred, especially with the Soviet Union and things that he got going. It's really fascinating what he accomplished and a lot of things that people don't realize. And then just the personality of the man is very interesting. So he's always been my favorite.
Jacob, who's your favorite?
So I feel like my serious answer would fall along one of the predictable lines of like maybe a Lincoln or Washington. So I'm going to give my ironic favorite. It's going to be, I believe it's President William Henry Harrison, the guy who died after a month because he gave his inaugural speech outside.
That is just
incredible. I mean, that would never happen again, I don't think. I mean, the presidents are well advised, they're well staffed. I mean, I just can't believe that actually happened to the leader of the United States.
He was so bullheaded that he wasn't going to put on a coat, and he just went out. And the speech was like the longest in American history or something like that, wasn't it? It was like 2 hours long or something.
Just a shout out to that just brazen leadership right there.
Leadership or stupidity, one or the other. Okay, Mike, who's your favorite?
Well, I have a soft spot for Barack Obama. I think history will treat him kinder than he is treated today. But I have to say that the first George Bush, George H.W. Bush, I think is one of the underrated presidents of our time. I liked his line about compassionate conservatism. But you have to remember that he won the first Persian Gulf War in 4 days. Nobody else seems to be able to wrap up military action in less than 10 years anymore.
Point. All right. Well, thanks, guys. And to all our listeners, have a happy President's Day. Thank you, AT&T, for sponsoring this and all our other podcasts. Until next week, I'm Kyle Malin. Take care.